Welcome to USA Football's Coach and Coordinator Podcast, where top football coaches from around the country share their stories, philosophies, concepts, and strategies to help you get better on and off the field. Now, here's your host, Keith Grabowski.
Welcome to USA Football's Coaching Coordinator Podcast. We continue with our series with state champions from 2017. And joining me today on the podcast is the head football coach at Christian Brothers College High School in Missouri, Division VI state champ, Scott Pingle. Coach, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Keith. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Well, Coach, let's talk a little bit before we get going into what you guys did in 2017. Like I was telling you, I was watching your highlights before we got going here on the podcast, and you have an impressive team, some great players there. But before we get into that, let's get a little bit into your background. I know that you you had a great playing career, Division III level, and you also coached at the Division III level as well. But give us a little bit about your start in coaching.
I finished up playing college football in 1999, was my last year. You're right, I had a pretty decent career, had some good things go for me. And then I started my college coaching right at my alma mater, Westminster College in Fulton, Missouri. I stayed on there as, I guess, essentially the GA / receiver coach. And then within 2 years, I was named offensive coordinator. I stayed there for 3 years. So I coached there a total of 5 years. And in the meantime, I was still able to play. I played a year of football myself in Europe, and I played 3 years of the indoor league in St. Charles, Missouri. So I kind of was getting to get to coach and play at the same time. I got to see both sides of the ball. And then after the 2004 season, my wife and I relocated to St. Louis, Missouri, and I've been here at this school now my 13th year and the 10th year as head coach.
Coach, looking back on that transition, and it's a unique one. Most guys stop playing and start coaching. You were doing a little bit of both, so how did that aid in your development as a coach, being in a phase where you're playing and you're coaching?
Yeah, I think it was nice, because I think the thing that people don't understand when you get into coaching, it is nothing like playing. It is totally, totally different, because you're now, instead of having to think, you're trying to try to think like others and try to figure out how to get inside their brain. So when I got to play and coach at the same time, even though I was coaching college and playing in the indoor league, it was just kind of refreshing, because I could take what I knew the team was trying to do against us and really apply it to whatever I was doing playing. I mean, the game really, really slowed down, because I really understood it a lot better, to the point at times, though, I was a receiver that I'm running across the middle, I'm expecting a big hit and the safety's not there. I'm like, okay, you messed up. So I could kind of on the fly realize that, sometimes the coverages weren't worth exactly. So it made me realize that, what you teach, what you coach is not always what you see. So you got to really see it through the eyes of your players when you coach.
So how's that carried into your current coaching? Obviously, that's impacted you greatly. How does that make its way into what you do now with your high school players?
I think every year, definitely I think in the last 15 years of coaching, kids have changed a little bit. So we really got to adapt to what they do, what they like. I think these kids are more visual. They definitely want to be shown things either through a medium of the classroom, of instruction. I don't think that's very high on their list anymore. They'd rather see it through a video. They'd rather see it through demonstration. So I think, you take the perspective of how do these kids learn, and you try to mold what you know to how they can learn.
Coach, looking at that transition going from player coach then into just being a coach, what were some of the things that impacted your development there as you – I know for a while there, in fact, American Football Monthly had named you one of the hottest coaches in Division III football. So, what was a spark for you, I guess, in your coaching that really helped your development along the way?
I think it's an adage of that I failed right away, because I thought that, okay, when I went from playing to coaching, oh, I know if they give me the soft coverage, I know what to, transition this route to. If they give me a press coverage, I knew what to do. It was natural when I played. And coaching was unnatural. So then I had to kind of relearn everything through a different perspective. And I think that's kind of went with me throughout my coaching career, is that you got to adapt. You can't stay in your ways. You can't always think that this is the way we have to do it. And I think that's kind of what offense have done, defense have done. Everyone kind of keeps evolving. And if you're not evolving, then you're really going to be left behind.
In your evolution as a coach, stepping out of the role of being an offensive coordinator and going into, being a head coach, how did that change things for you? And what has been your role, I guess, moving forward with, you know, being an offensive guy, you're still calling plays, or have you delegated that?
Yeah, being an assistant coach was definitely a situation where, you know, you're definitely coaching a group, you're coaching players, you're coaching an offensive scheme, but really you're doing X's and O's. You're building, you're forging relationships in the weight room, you know, all those things. But when you transition to a head coach, I don't think there's a good manual out there to really tell you all the things you're going to have to deal with, whether it be, you know, ordering gear, whether it be setting up preseason, postseason meetings, whether it be talking to the parents, whether it be getting ready for the booster club. There's just, you can talk to people, you can do a lot of different things, but you just got to really experience what it's like to be a head coach. Early on in my career, I tried to keep my relationships with parents the same way. Sometimes you can be cordial, sometimes you can invite them to places and talk to them. And then when I became a head coach, I realized that, you know, blood's pretty thick there. So I was a little bit more guarded in my early days as a head coach, just because I forged those relationships, but I also understood that now being the man in charge, that they might not always agree with me, and they'll tear me down in a heartbeat if they have to. So, you know, you had to rethink about how close you got to people, but I still love my kids, and, you know, I work with them like they're my own children. So that part's never changed, but it's definitely totally different being an assistant to a head coach.
As you take the reins and you have the opportunity to, you know, build your culture, shape your culture of your team, that, first of all, I guess, you know, prefacing that, you're at an organization that has a very strong culture. You know, Christian Brothers College High School does an excellent job. There's high expectations there. So how do you take those and, you know, develop those on the field, translate what's really the culture in the classroom in the school to a culture in a football team?
You know, I think football is a little bit under attack right now, and our numbers are dwindling. And actually, I've seen my numbers rise. And I think that takes a little, you know, shot of what we do with our culture here, because I think people want to be part of this. We have a lot of good players, but we also have a lot of players that like to be part of something, that understand their role. They understand they may be a scout team guy as a senior. They may understand that we're going to run down a kickoff team, but they've accepted the role. We make every role meaningful. We do a lot of team building, a lot of unity. We do a two-night, 3-day at this place called Glencoe, Missouri, where, if you can remember the Titans movie, where it's like no air conditioning, no TVs, no anything. They unfortunately have their cell phones, but it's, you know, it's basically the old, you're out in the woods and you're playing football for 3 days, and then, you know, they have to bond. They have to get together. And then we're real big. Everything we do is competition. You know, we talk about that all the time. You know, you compete in pregame warm-ups, you compete in practice, you compete at, you know, the weight room, you compete in the trainings, you compete in silly relay races. You know, pretty well everything we do has a winner and loser. And but we actually kind of say winner or learner now. You're always trying to learn from a mistake. So we kind of make the culture about winning, competing, and, you know, at the end of it all, you're there for each other.
Coach, you mentioned, you know, football being under attack and numbers dwindling and those kinds of things. First of all, in your opinion, seeing everything that's going on out there, has the high school football coach in general been able to, I guess, express their voice in what their role and what needs to happen in order to save the game, to make it better, to help it move forward and survive?
I do think we have definitely tried to move it forward. We try to make it survive. You know, we're more educated. We have more docs on the sideline, just like a lot of schools. We do a concussion baseline testing before, and then if they have a concussion, they have to retest, and there's a 7-step protocol to get back on the field. We do try to relay that message to as many people as we can. We try to make sure parents are hearing that message. But at the end of the day, I really feel the game's safer now than it has been in a long time. Like, I think we know more about the game. I just think that some people already have their own opinion, so we got to definitely do everything we can to sway it. I think you really got to hit on the positives of what football brings. I mean, it's not another sport out there where 11 guys can choreograph and some poetry on the field. I mean, it really is beautiful if you think about, you know, all 11 guys have to trust each other. All 11 guys have to really believe in what they're doing. It teaches them so much that it's not even really about the X and O's, and that's the message we try to hit home to the parents.
Coach, thinking of, you know, some of the things that you guys do as teachers to prepare your team, you know, before they hit the field, you mentioned it, you know, using video more and really relating to the players in a way that's relevant to them. What are some of the best things you guys are doing from a kind of a method or a strategic way of installing your stuff before you hit the field?
Yeah, I think, well, we basically, you know, do it in three different platforms. We tell them, we show them, and then we actually do demonstrations on the field. What we saw from a couple colleges we went to, we start every day, and this is nothing new, but we found that it really helped us. We start every day with our walkthrough. And it's actually a period where they actually walk through the entire team script as fast as you can and try to get reps, and it teaches them how you want to play up-tempo and fast and make them think. But in a way where they're just kind of getting to see it in a method that's slowed down when the actual play snaps. So I think walkthroughs have helped quite a bit. The other thing that I really like that we started doing about 3 or 4 years ago is we will have captains of the position groups lead practice. Now, we'll give them a little bit of an idea of what they want. Okay, during this drill or during this session, we want these type of drills. During this team session, we want this. And what we found over the time is that, you know, sometimes you don't think teenage boys are hearing you. But when they have to coach and instruct, they're using some of the same language, some of the same terminology. They're able to convey a message maybe a little bit different to the other teenage boy that maybe understood a little bit better because it's coming from a peer. So we found that the peers, educating the peers, have been kind of one of the best things we've done.
Talk to me a little bit more about that and the setup of it and how you make that work just from a procedural standpoint.
Basically, we'll give them our practice schedule. We'll create an entire practice schedule. And as if we were going to run to practice, but then we say, okay, now, and each position coach, you know, the nine units have their main coach. And then, you know, I'd talk to the quarterback, say, okay, my quarterback's named Brett. I said, okay, today, Brett and Indy, I want to focus on these type of drills, and we want to work on this type of footwork, and we want to work on this ending of the RPO we're looking at. And then, you know, through the instruction, he's just kind of, you're just sitting in the background, just kind of watching him go through it. Now, this definitely has to be monitored because the kids sometimes, you know, will clown, so you better make sure you have a perfect script going exactly what you want it. And what we found is that we're a signal team, and what we found that when we had our guys signal, not everybody knew the signal. So right there, it hit us like, oh, we better reteach our signals, or we better reteach this. So the other thing we found is that the kids really are creative. They might do a ring drill where they're trying to run around a ring on the outside linebacker rush drill, and then all of a sudden, you know, they may put another wrinkle in there. Let's put a towel here and a towel here as we scoop up. So it's kind of fun because you learn what they know, but then also what they're kind of thinking when they're doing it. So it's kind of a cool process.
It reminds me, as we started talking about what you were learning kind of as a guy, both playing and coaching, is kind of what these guys have the opportunity now to do as well.
Yeah, without a doubt, because I think that, you know, I think coaching is not – coaches take it for granted that it's easy. It's really not an easy task because you got to try to figure out how to get 100 guys on the same page. And then if you break it down in a smaller group, get those 9 to 12 guys in a group on the same page. But when the peers are involved and your leaders are involved, I mean, I hate to say it, but I think in 2018 – the kids may listen to each other more than an adult or authoritative figure sometimes. So if you can get those kids to buy in and be leaders and then coach them as well, I mean, it's a win-win.
Coach, how often do you guys do that?
You know, it's more in the early. It's more in the summer camps and spring. But because once you're in that routine, you know, your Tuesday's a certain day, Wednesday's a certain day. So it's basically more in the summer. You know, we may do – I can think of two of these at the Glencoe experience. Our guys run two of those practices down there. Because it's in that unity situation, and then we do maybe one or two during the summer as well. So maybe in our 20 days of summer practice, we may have 4 of them.
Yeah, I think it's a great opportunity. I think, like what you said there about kind of the players evolving some of those drills, adding things to it, and the opportunity really from the coaches to learn from that. I really believe that your football team's going to be best if the coaches are out there learning something every day as well. I know, you know, having been a college offensive coordinator, one of the best experiences for me as we evolved our system every year is, you know, especially a lot with our procedures, players would come back and say, hey, coach, what if we did this and we made this like one of our tempos? And they would have some great adjustments or tweaks, or they might think of something in a technique that works a little bit better than the way they were teaching it. And I think that's a situation where you get that buy-in as well, that the players really start buying into it rather than running around out there like robots.
Yeah, and definitely I think the buy-in is what you're looking for, but I think you hit it perfectly. Do not be a robot. You've got to play this sport with reactionary response to everything, so you cannot just go through the motions because we're telling you to do it. And I've loved it. I think it's really been a great thing for us, and our buy-in's been pretty good the last couple of years.
Coach, give us a brief overview of the systems that you run, your offense and your defense.
our offense, I guess you can say we're multiple. We're very up-tempo, as fast as we can go, as far as fast as high school officials will let you go anyways. You know, we can go from two backs, we can go 12 personnel all the way to 20 personnel to 10 personnel. I mean, we're all over the place on offense, so we can go a whole bunch of different sets. And the defense, we're multiple now. We've been 3-4 for the last decade or so, and now we're starting to incorporate the little 4-2-5, a little 3-3 stack. So, you know, I kind of always talk to my defensive guys, like, look, this is what's giving me fits. So they've kind of evolved to go a couple of different fronts and different shades and different movements. So I think we're very just multiple, and I think that's kind of where the sport's going to right now.
So, Coach, how do you have a multiple system and keep it exactly like that, a system rather than a collection of plays? You know, so you mentioned, for example, you were 3-4, now you're a little bit of 3-3, 4-2-5. Those things have to fit together. How do you ensure that you're fitting all those things together and staying within a system that has answers?
Well, I think that you can just kind of really look at the I don't know if evolution is a word. I don't know what the opposite of evolution is, but you know, the lack of defensive linemen in the United States now, or maybe in St. Louis, you know, I think so. Basically, the defenses are getting smaller and quicker, I think. So, Our outside linebackers are very key to our defense because they're our guys that go from a 3-4. They're the guys that can put their hand in the ground and come off the edge. They're the guy that can go to 3-3 stack. They're the guy that can kind of cover in space. So, we're probably looking for some of our most athletic guys at outside linebacker, and those guys can do the multiple things. And I think we're as smart as our players can allow us to be, actually. So we've been having a lot of creativity these last couple of years because we've had players that gave us that ability. But you still got to work around your system. And I think that our players, you know, we're in a situation where we're getting to reap some benefits of playing some young guys early on. Played a lot of sophomores that are now going to be seniors next year. So, you know, it's kind of, you can push the envelope a little bit more and see how much these guys can take on.
Coach, looking back at this past season, your state championship season, what are some of the takeaways from that season? Some things that either went really well and you're going to stick with and maybe build on, or maybe some things that you got to look at and tweak a little bit because you didn't get quite what you wanted out of it.
A couple things. I mean, this might be a long-winded answer, but, you know, we August 4th, it was our fourth day of summer camp, and we lost our star receiver. He's committed to Ohio State. He tore his ACL from the same practice. We lost our outside linebacker. He's about 6'4", 250, who's a big-time D1 recruit. And I think there was like a sigh of like, what's going to happen now? We lost two of our main dudes day four. But it was kind of neat. It was like the next guy kind of stood up. Next guy went after it, you know. And then it reinvigorated me that there still are team sports out there. These guys started really playing for each other. They weren't waiting for that one guy to make the play anymore. They weren't waiting for that one person to make the catch anymore. They weren't waiting for that one guy to make the tackle and be the superhero. They said, okay, if I do my piece and this guy does his piece, you know, collectively we can be pretty damn special. And that's kind of what I took away from this past year. You know, they show me the passion and unselfishness can still be in teenage kids. They showed me that you know, drive is just as important as athleticism. So these guys are really determined, and that's kind of what I would take away from it. The piece that I got to work on better, you know, we had two other injuries that I didn't really talk about, but we had four or five guys go down this year, and I got to just do a little bit better on injury protocol, on expectations of what to do when a guy is injured other than go to the trainer, what's their expectations for practice, what's their expectations for dress, because I felt like I probably did those guys a disservice. Maybe they felt a little bit out of the loop of what's going on week to week, and they're still part of our team, so I got to learn from that part a little bit more. If we want to talk X and O's, that's a whole different story. But, you know, those are the main takeaways I'll take from the 2017 season, that, you know, total buy-in still wins, teams still win, and individual players, you know, coming together can be pretty damn special.
Absolutely. Well, Coach, I would love to talk about those X's and O's. And I obviously we have the challenge of audio here to talk about those things. But, you know, what was the takeaway for you in the X and O area?
You know, I think offensively, We had a great group of guys up front. We had five guys, the returners, the starters. They did a great job for us last year. I got a quarterback back there that can kind of sling it through the RPOs. He understands all the reads. He understands what we're trying to do. He's a guy that I can just kind of say, okay, Brett, here's what we're trying to do. Now you take it over and run with it. He's a guy I have total trust in. I can kind of say, what are you thinking? I know he'll give me real feedback. You know, we love to take what the defense gives us. If you're going to leave the bubble uncovered, we're going to sling the bubble out. If you want to cover the bubble, I feel like we can block 6-on-6 with our bigs, and then or 6-on-7 if we want to read the end. So I think what I'll take away offensively, X and O's, you know, I love the one back power. I love outside zone. I love being able to get on the perimeter. I love how my receivers blocked this past year. We took a big pride in blocks, and whether it be for the bubble or coming down to force crack on the safeties, I thought our guys did a lot of good things paying attention to the detail. Defensively, our X and O's, pretty simple. We're going to try to take away what you do best. Most high school teams love to run the ball in our conference, in our league, so we definitely try to load the box and try to play some man coverage on the outside. You know, we're fortunate that we got some dudes that can cover. And you know, you got to have a little swag when you play DB, and we got a few guys that have that moxie. So X and O's, man, we're going to bring pressure on defense and make you feel uncomfortable and then try to take away what you do best.
Coach, the one-back power obviously is something I love. We had a lot of success with it at the college level, but I also have noticed there's so many different ways of teaching that power. Talk to us a little bit about some of the key coaching points you have for the one-back power.
You know, Coach, I don't know if we're right on this or not, but we actually try to teach our O-linemen schemes. We feel that the one-back power versus a 3-4 is different than the one-back power versus a 3-3 stack versus a 4-2-5. So we really try to teach, okay, you're identifying the front. You know, we're trying to figure out who's double-teaming, who's climbing. So against the forefront, you know, we're big on the guard and tackle side, center, you're doubling back. And now we're going to RPO the backside backer. We're going to teach the hinge steps to our guard or to our backside tackle. Now what we've done recently is we let our backside tackle sift through the B gap. And if he feels that DN can't make the play because our quarterback's responsible for him, then we'll just climb. And, you know, we felt that our climb's been pretty good through the year. We love it to a tight end as well, especially if they don't want to put anybody in the overhang position, because then we can fold our tight end through the B gap as well and get a lot of different looks. So our one back power, we run a front side, we run a back side. You know, it's just been pretty good staple for us. And, you know, it's really identifying the fronts and reaction. You know, I don't believe that every play needs to be ran the same way versus every front, or different fronts.
Mm-hmm. What kind of attachments are you using with the RPO? What's the routes you're running?
Well, you know, we do like to run the slant replacement pop routes, but I like that more of an attached tight end, because I feel like that overhang guy can kind of gray things up a little bit, so I like him more attached. We'll run our quick hitch game. We'll run our bubble, and then our fake off the bubbles there. We love the smoke screen to the one receiver, or to the two receiver side, to the boundary. I love boundary stuff because I think sometimes high school, the hash marks really make people feel teams, so I feel like you can get boundary stuff pretty good there. So, you know, we're probably no different than most. We like to throw the hitch game, the stick game, and then basically a lot of the bubbles or the smoke screens.
Coach, with the RPO, obviously has come the need and the ability to practice it the right way. So what do you guys do in practice to be able to work all the components and the read part of that RPO?
You know, that's a good question. That's something that we are still sifting through, because right now, even when we're in our inside run drill, you know, we tell our quarterback to just tell me if you're going to give or throw, even though it's a give every time. In our individual time, we do a lot of stuff where I'm the read guy. We're throwing there. We do a bubble screen game every single day versus our DBs, because I think it's pretty important to know how to block. It's not just block the guy over you. We ooze off the line of scrimmage, and you got to figure out who's triggering, and then you got to work off that. You know, if we're doing our slant replacement pop routes, or if we're doing the stick routes, you know, obviously I'm the backer there. But we try to teach our quarterback, you know, okay, a 3-4, this is who we're reading. A 3-3, this is who we're reading. So we try to teach who we're reading and then work off that. And, mm-hmm. You know, we've been doing RPO since 14, so we've been doing it now 4 years, and we're still learning as we go. I think these things keep evolving. You know, I've read a good article, and I'm trying to – we're working through it right now. Are we blocking it like we don't care if our O-linemen get downfield? Are we teaching our O-linemen what an RPO is? So that's what we're talking about right now. Is it important that our O-linemen know it's an RPO, or – you know, we ran about 600-700 plays last year, and probably 500 were RPOs, and we got called 3 or 4 times downfield. Is that worth chasing now? I think officials are probably being alerted to it a little bit more. So that's the type of conversation we're having right now, and we don't know if we need to tell our old linemen it's an RPO or not right now.
Yeah, that's a tough one. I know, you know, we had done some things with RPO, and prior to that, you know, our play action package, we didn't, you know, they would know by the attachment it was a pass. But we told them we wanted them to aggressively block the run. And so in the time we were doing that, I think over the course of 3 years, we had it called twice. And what we found, it wasn't from guys actually releasing and getting to the linebackers too early. It was from them really kicking someone's butt off of the line of scrimmage and driving them downfield. And we said, we'll take that one. You know, that's something we'll take. We don't want to take out the aggressiveness. And obviously, for these things to work, you'd need those, you know, clear, distinctive reads for the defense that tell them, you know, it's a run, get over here, right, and open that hole. So I agree with you. It's a tough one. Certain schemes handle it. I know I've seen guys go more to the pin and pull or the outside zone, but I think, you know, power, right, can really open up some lanes for your guys if you do it right. But I would say with those numbers, Coach, you guys are doing it pretty well. I probably wouldn't tinker with it too much and get those guys worried about it.
Yeah, when we did throw, kind of what you said, our play action, we would say aggressively block, but at the end of the day, our guys knew it was a pass, so they'd kind of aggressively block for a half count, then all of a sudden go high hat, and we're like, okay, you didn't sell it. And we found the RPOs basically do a great job of selling it. So, you know, we may end up tagging a word at the end to tell our guys, you know, don't go downfield or stay on the double a little bit longer. But for the most part, we tell our guys it's a run, go after them, and then, you know, we're probably going to preach stay on the D-line a little bit longer. I guess what I've heard from talking with some former players who are now in college ranks that, you know, a lot of the old linemen now are reading backers, mm-hmm, and you're reading their flow, and if they trigger, you trigger. If they drop, you stay at the line. So that's something we're going to look at right now, but we definitely don't want to take away the aggressiveness. And if it takes away the aggressiveness, then we're going to go back to the old way and live with the penalties if we get them.
Yeah, that's definitely, I think, one of the keys to the success of the RPO and why so many people have adapted it into their offense is it's just so difficult for that dual responsibility player. You know, you cannot play both the run and the pass if the offense is aggressively executing both.
Yeah, without a doubt. Now, you know, I think teams are really trying to make that safety part a little bit part more of the RPO to try to take him away. You know, they play man, but I think that safety coming down, being the next guy in the box, now, you know, the third level RPO is coming play, and you got to really make sure you don't get anybody downfield on those.
Yeah, and, you know, in looking at RPOs, the third level, I always felt like the power might be the best one to execute with third level, you know, again, because, you know, if I'm the safety, I'm reading keys, and you're running one back power. I mean, there is no doubt that looks like a run to me, and I got to fit. So now, you know, that kind of that bang it post, that, you know, that post that the quarterback's right, able to drive in there, I think becomes really effective.
Yeah, I totally agree, and that's something – it's fun too when you got a quarterback and kind of make those decisions back there for you too, you know. But I think it's fun to watch the evolution of a high school quarterback too. I mean, 10 years ago, we call a play and live with it. Now we're giving these guys three options and say, okay, 16-year-old kid, make me right.
Yeah, definitely. But we kind of, obviously, you know, I've seen guys talk about that too. Like, I'm not going to put the decision, you know, my job on the line with a 16-year-old kid. But, you know, ultimately we're playing a game. And if we're doing a good job as teachers, we're not putting our job on the line. We're doing right, our job in practice to be able to get them to execute on game day.
Yeah, and I think that's the beauty of game week. I mean, you're preparing for that one test every Friday night. My coach and I joke all the time, I hate install because, you know, everybody's installing, everybody's doing things, but I'm like, okay, I don't like this play versus defense, but we're installing it, so let's take a peek at it. So that's why game plan is always fun. You kind of get through your menu of items you want to look at. Okay, these are the five runs we want to take into. These are the seven passes we want to take into. Whereas install, you know, you as a defense coordinator, unfortunately, are getting a lot of fights because, you know, we wouldn't call that play versus defense, but yeah, we need to because we're installing it. So
right,
it's kind of funny.
Yeah, always. It's funny in camp, too, when there's time like that, how the scheming starts to take place, like, you know. I know
you definitely got to grab some call sheets from time to time.
Yeah, you do. You change those up. Maybe you know, they say the guy with the chalk last wins. So, I mean, it's almost like the guy who prints the call sheet, you know, which had both sets of calls on wins. For me, it was always, I didn't care too much, but at least once a practice, I wanted to see the defensive coordinator throw his script up in the air and it would make me happy.
I'm with you. And that's another thing. I hate screen periods. I would love to hear anybody how they practice screen periods really well, because those things do nothing but tick me off because we can't practice them to save my life.
It's so hard. I got away from almost even calling some of the live screens in practice just because our defense was so good at them. It was like a wasted rep. So, you know, we were always looking at that too, whether we would just do it, you know, with landmarks out there and how to, you know, I think that's always an error. I think everybody's always looking at how do you practice and get good at screens. And some of it is, I've come to the fact that, like, yeah, it's going to look kind of bad in practice, but in the game, it'll all work out.
Well, then Keith, I need to adapt your style because I'm one of those coaches that if it doesn't look good in practice, I hate calling it. But we've been talking about these screens for about 5 years now. You know, besides our like T screen or just a running back screen, we can do that. We can't do the tunnel screens. We stuck at you know, the middle screens. I'm just like, because our defense always gives us looks, and I always say, nope, that plays out. You know, so I got to just be able to stick with them a little bit more.
Well, Coach, as you approach the 2018 season here, and you know, we got things kicked off. Certainly, I'm sure the goal is to get back there again, to stay at the top. And you guys had done it before in 14. You're back here after a championship in 17. You know, what do you feel is the biggest challenge your team needs to address to be able to get back to that level again?
I think it's going to sound corny, but it's pretty simple. Our leaders need to lead. And by that, I mean we got about 9 or 10 guys that will be 3-year starters. And if they let complacency sit in themselves or the team, then, you know, I think it's going to not be a good year. But if they just sit there and still are hungry and still want to prove something, still want to play for those letters across their chest, you know, that's what it's going to take. I mean, this team's got a lot of talent coming back. You know, we're returning all 5 old linemen. We're returning a quarterback, 2 tight ends, you know, 2 defensive linemen, 3 linebackers, 2 secondary guys. I mean, we got a lot of depth coming back from a pretty good team. So if complacency doesn't set in and our leaders lead, I like our chances.
Absolutely. Coach, the last question I have for you guys are doing a lot of great things, obviously. You have to be able to get to this level. But if I ask you to just point to one thing that really gives your team the winning edge, what is that?
I think, well, that's a great question. I just really think that the buy-in. You know, we've been down a couple times. We were down 14 last year in the second half, and our guys never hesitate to think we'd come back. So I think they really buy in that whatever we do, it's going to work. You know, one of the things I talk about, where our mantra is be a brick, and I know it sounds corny, but a brick by itself needs to be strong, needs to be powerful. So we try to say each individual person has to be powerful and strong, and then you can come together as a wall. So I think it really builds on that mentality of I got to take care of myself, and then I can really count on that guy next to me. So I'd say it's our buy-in, Coach.
Great stuff, Coach. How can our listeners connect with you if they want to learn a little bit more from you?
They can shoot me an email at pingels@cbchs.org, or you can find us at on the website at www.cbchs.org, and that'll take you to everything you need to know about CBC football.
Coach Pingel, I appreciate you taking time here. Congratulations again on your 2017 state championship, and best wishes and good luck as you go forward in 2018.
Hey, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to USA Football's Coach and Coordinator Podcast. For more resources, visit the Coach Performance Center at usafootball.com.